Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for November 23rd, 2017, Thanksgiving Day evening, and a lot of families tune in and listen to this show. It's like right at supper time, there's kind of a tradition. Sometimes new guests are over, so if you're a new guest, you've never heard this show before, welcome. And I discuss topics from a, let's say, a different point of view, scientific topics. So put on your seatbelt, and basically, first of all, I want to give a Thanksgiving thanks. Thanks to all of my fans out there, the regular people that listen to this show, talk to other people about it, and basically gain an understanding of how things work. My background is in physics, mathematics. I have a very good science background. I've studied the history of science. And as a result, it's moved me in many interesting directions. And once again, for those who are not familiar with my work. And I've got probably 10 or 11 books on the market now, which are sold only on my webpage. And a number of DVDs. Some of them are still the old-fashioned hard DVD, and some of the newer ones are downloadable DVDs, CDs, information. And let me just tell the people that are listening for the first time, you are barraged, if you're not aware of this, by standard science, which is really ludicrous. Most of the theories that they propound could not possibly be true, and a lot of them having to do with the history of man. What we've been taught from the time we walked into kindergarten about the history of man, it couldn't possibly be true. Not at all. And every time a new contradiction comes up, well, nobody even talks about it because they'd have to change the textbooks and everything else. But the unfortunate part of this is your kids, who you're paying a lot of money to go to an educational system that's broken and really is full of archaic, out-of-date, bad information. So anyway, with that in mind, but what do we have to be thankful for? I really, in spite of all of the trauma in the world and the fact that the volcano in Iceland, the biggest volcano in the North Atlantic, is just about ready to blow. This would drastically affect Europe. All of Europe would be affected if this happens. Keeping an eye on that for sure. But in spite of the trauma that we go through on Earth, earthquakes, volcanoes, hurricanes, you know, this was the year of the hurricane. And if you've listened to past shows, you know my work dealing with that. But in spite of all of the trauma, there has never been a time in man's known history. There's a lot of history of man we do not know about. But in terms of what we do know about, things today for the average person listening to this show are pretty good. Our complaints are mild compared to the complaints of 100 years ago, or certainly 1,000 years ago, or certainly 2,000 years ago. The average person did not have it very good. The average lifespan was maybe 25 years. You had two or three kids, and by the time you hit 25, you were dead. So things are a bit better now. You know, and we're all sitting down, hopefully. People are sitting down to a good meal, Thanksgiving meal, celebrating the first Thanksgiving where the pilgrims successfully managed a summer, and through harvest, through natural foraging in the woods, etc., up there in Massachusetts, what is now Massachusetts, knew that they had done enough to survive the winter. And they weren't the first colony. Some of the first colonies, the first groups to come over, they came back and they just weren't there. Nobody knows what happened to them. So the first the pilgrims who were escaping religious persecution in Europe came to the United States or this new land. And if they would have come a bit farther south, they would have probably been much more successful. But they landed in a very cold climate. So anyway, the end result, Thanksgiving Day celebration. And a couple of years ago, there was a big movement to discredit Thanksgiving. So Thanksgiving did happen. There was a Thanksgiving, first Thanksgiving dinner, and that's what we're celebrating now. So putting it into perspective, the way I see it, we have it pretty good. You go to the grocery store, you know, you go down to the gas station, you get a candy bar and something to drink. And those people did not have the corner gas station. They didn't, whatever they had, it was because they made it or produced it with their own hands. So things today, much, much better. Quality of life, much better. In spite of the fact that we can all point to things that we don't like or whatever, put it into perspective and you have a lot to be thankful for. And in kids, what I would encourage kids to do, whether you're 3 or 5 or 10 or 20 or big kids like me, you know, elderly kids, we're all kids at heart, put effort into bettering yourself. What I think parents and grandparents should do is take that extra effort to move your kids in new directions. Because unfortunately, the schools have a very set program, and a lot of times kids' development takes place away from school because there's no avenue for kids to develop their talents at school. So they have garage bands, they have, you know, they meet outside of school. So try and become involved with the kids, see what they want to do, and then help them out. Put things in front of them. If they want to be artists, musicians, poets, writers, and maybe there will be passing fads, but all of those things are part of their development. And make sure they know how to write with a pen and paper. That's very important. I still have piles of notes and papers, and people make fun of me because I have a lot of notes, handwritten notes, not in a computer, not in a laptop. And I think that's something that's been lost. Organization. When you write something down, it's like you have a better connection to that than if you typed it into a computer. So just a few tips. And then also be very wary of what you're being taught and told, especially from the standard news media today. And I would encourage people also, being a little bit maybe egotistical here, get my books and give them to the kids. Say, here, this is a different point of view. Read this, and it's going to take you on a little bit different journey than you're going to find in the standard school system. Okay, a couple quick notices here. Richard Branson, of course, the billionaire from Virgin Records, Virgin Galactic, Virgin Airlines, Virgin, many, many different sub-companies that Branson owns, or is at least part owner, and Elon Musk of SpaceX. And there again, Musk is a guy who has many branches, many corporations that he has formed and started. These two guys have joined forces to create. Branson has put a lot of money in, so his name is now going in a joint venture with Elon Musk's Hypertube travel system, where you can go hundreds of miles an hour, and they're building some prototypes right now on the West Coast. But to move people quickly between, say, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and without getting on an airplane. So this is something that's maybe the future, where they evacuate the tube from with air, and then it's like a rail system where they can go very quickly. People can move. My way of thinking when I do business or whatever I do, it's typically on the internet. I do interviews, I do television, radio interviews, I do my own radio show. And through my opinion is, people don't have to travel anymore to do business. You know, you don't have to get on an airline, go from New York to Los Angeles to have a business meeting. Why would you transport the people? Because they can be in the same room with basically telephony, the Skype or other systems. There's many, many systems out there where you can have a conference and the people can be all over the world, and you avoid that major expense of everybody flying all over and staying in hotels and business lunches, etc. So anyway, but there are still that genre of people, businessmen, who want to be there. They want to go to the location, etc. And so be it. But anyway, that's just worth noting. Also worth noting that Virgin, Branson's company, just got the first Department of Defense launch contract. So that's interesting, because before he was strictly tourism, public tourism, public into space. And Musk was the one who was edging in on the military launches, cutting into the business of Boeing and other big corporations that traditionally had a corner on that market. But now Branson is entering those military markets. So anyway, the Christmas star. We're all coming up on Christmas, and I think a lot of people anyway who listen to this show are Christians. And the Christmas star I've talked about before. I had a special dealing with the Christmas star many years ago with a host from WCCO radio in Minneapolis, a guy named Brad Walton, a good friend of mine who passed away a number of years ago, bless his heart. But Brad was just a really educated, wonderful person. And we did a Christmas special on the Christmas star one time. And I don't have that with me. I should post that at some time on my, as a permanent feature on my webpage. But you are going to be barraged in the next month, I promise you. You are going to be barraged by people trying to tell you that the Christmas star was a planetary alignment. And that is not true. It couldn't possibly be true. And it's one of the, like I say, pieces of complete misinformation being touted amongst standard science and astronomy, in astronomy circles. Why could the Christmas star not have been a planetary alignment? Well, number one, the Christmas star was something unusual. Planetary alignments happen all the time. We could look in the last 6 months, there have probably been a couple of them. And certainly when the Christmas star came along, the people who watched the stars, the three wise men, King Herod, lots of other people who were knowledgeable about the stars and what we call astrology today, but and that really has gotten a bad rap because it has turned into something of mysticism and cult worship, things like that. But back in the old days, the study of the heavens, and there were predictions dealing with the coming of a Messiah, a savior for the world. And so the Christmas star was something special. People had waited thousands of years for this. And when it showed up, three kings in three completely different lands in the east noticed this or saw it. They studied the stars, packed their bags, and headed. Well, they discovered it in the east. And they followed it to the west, which is a very typical thing for a comet, that it goes behind the sun, and so at one point it's in the eastern sky, but then when they started following it, it was in the western sky. So they followed it until it came to rest over the nativity, the magi scene, or the magi were the kings, but the birthplace of Christ. And so, and this is a real story. Now, what's informative about three kings? Well, if it was one, you'd say, well, you know, maybe he was just, you know, reading something into it. If you had two, you'd say, well, two guys noticed it. That's pretty good odds that it wasn't something random. Three guys noticing it pretty much locks in that this was a real event, something that everybody was looking for. So it, the travel time, the time it took them to get ready to go, the time across traveling across the desert, they finally met up, the three of them, and traveled in together the rest of the way. This didn't happen overnight. This took months and possibly years. So the Christmas star, the idea that it would be a planetary alignment is a matter of a few hours, and then the alignment goes away, and it's just a visual alignment. It's not anything like it's going to affect Earth or gravitational. No, it's simply a visual alignment in the heavens of a couple of planets, two or three, or it could be even four, or even more. I mean, we have potentially, at that time, the seven planets. Remember, back in those days, they knew of seven planets. And so the idea is that a planetary alignment, even if there's multiple planets, doesn't last but a few hours. So in all respects, the idea, the false idea that the Christmas star was somehow planetary alignment is just ape off the wall crazy. It doesn't fit any of the scenarios that we know are true. And so it was something else. And like I said, planetary alignments happen all the time, you know, probably two, three a year. So the Christmas star had to be something unusual that over a period of a couple thousand years was very unique, that it only happened, and when those guys saw it, they go, wow, that is it. I'm dropping what I'm doing, and I'm heading out, because this is what we have all been waiting for up in those upper echelons of knowledge at that time. So, could the Christmas star be a planetary alignment? No. Not by any stretch of the imagination. And now, the way I explain this, a third grader, a second grader, a kindergartner could tell you that, no, the Christmas star could not possibly have been a planetary alignment. But the question, the big question, is why is standard astronomy promoting this in NASA? I mean, what do they got? Where's their axe to grind in this whole deal? And don't they notice how stupid what they're trying to pawn off on you, how stupid this story is? But then that brings up a bigger question. What are they trying to hide? I mean, these guys can't be that stupid. Maybe they are. But, I mean, they can't be that stupid. Not all of them. Maybe they are. But the real issue is, what are they trying to hide? And the ultimate answer is that the Christmas star was a comet. And it, you know, the characteristics of the Christmas star, it was, had a long tail. It had, and it came to rest over the birthplace of Christ. And it sat there. And that's, again, typical of a comet, where it'll, what we call retrograde, it just sits in the sky for a matter of days or weeks. And that's a typical of a retrograde motion of a comet in an orbit around the sun. So this object was a comet, which is very interesting, because it there's a lot more that goes on with comets. So I'm not going to talk about that particular venue tonight on that particular topic. But all I'm saying is, in the next number of weeks leading up to Christmas, you are going to be barraged by that phony concept. So just put on your seatbelt, put on your hip boots, and be prepared. I mentioned the Iceland volcanic eruption. Now, there have been some minor eruptions there in the last couple of years. And these eruptions were not full-blown eruptions, but the ash clouds then blow easterly across England and Europe, depending on which direction the wind is blowing. But the end result is they have to shut down air travel. In the closer areas, they may have to shut down roads and limit automobile traffic. And so it has a major effect on economy and just the people's ability to move. It could have a major effect on agriculture and animals, because an ash layer really kills everything. I mean, it just it's not conducive for plants to grow or animals to graze, and it's just ends that cycle of life that we all depend on for food. So anyway, we'll keep an eye on that. But that's a major story. A number of weeks ago, I talked about the Canary Islands and the possibility of an underwater landslide that could send a tsunami across the Atlantic Ocean in a matter of 6 hours to reach New York City and probably 8 to 9 hours to reach Miami, Florida. So the entire eastern coast of the United States, where literally about one-third of the U.S. population lives in those regions. And so hoping that Canary Island underwater earthquake activity ceases. They had many rumblings there over the last number of weeks. And so just hoping that goes away and does not raise its ugly head. Then the last few weeks I've been talking about comets to planets. And the comet we call K2. Now, for those people who are unaware of this, first of all, I want to inform you that comets are not what you've been told they are. If you went to school or you took an astronomy course in college, you were taught that comets are dirty snowballs. Well, I have news for you. They're not. They could not possibly be dirty snowballs. The European Space Agency has last landed on the nucleus of an active comet. There's no snow or ice or water on the nucleus. There's nothing coming off the nucleus. It's a hot, dry rock. And so how does that form a tail? Well, that's the basis of part of my work. But anyway, the comet K2 is interesting because it was discovered beyond the orbit of Saturn. It's the farthest comet ever discovered in the history of astronomy, farthest away from the sun. And it's already quite large. Now, there's two parts to the comet. There's the nucleus, which is the hard, rocky core, and then there's the coma, which is the gaseous cloud that surrounds the comet nucleus. And that gaseous cloud, the coma, is already larger than the planet Jupiter. So it's already visible. And this comet was actually discovered in 2013, but it was only publicized just recently, and the first original release of information on this was only this past May. So once again, the NASA, who did the study with the Pan-STAR automated search telescope system, NASA discovered this in 2013. so what's the real reason they had to release the information is because very soon amateurs were going to discover this and then announce it. So they wanted to keep the dialogue, so to speak, the which they create both sides. They wanted to keep that dialogue in under their umbrella. So that's why they finally had to release this information, even though it had been officially discovered in 2013 as a little fuzzy ball out in the far reaches of the solar system. But the point is that this comet will be coming into the solar system, and we don't really have good orbital data on it yet. There's an ephemeris had been published, and it's not sufficient to give real information that would allow us to calculate a final orbit for this object. And under normal circumstances, that would be the case. But the orbit of this comet will change. And as it comes into the solar system, it will change dramatically. And so predicting where it will be and what planets it may encounter, which could then again alter its orbit, is all of this is very difficult. So I don't have any final answers on this. I've talked about it over the last couple weeks. And by the way, I apologize. I've been 2 weeks in a row where I have not had the archives posted to this show, and I will be more up to date with that. I had been off on a mission and out of radio range, and so that's all past. I now have back. I've got my feet on the studio again, and so I'll be posting. I'll be keeping my webpage up a little bit better, and plus I was just relaxing a bit. I had about 2 months of very hectic, well, not hectic, as things are never real hectic, but it got a little bit, let's say, tense last August, late August, when I had to escape from Florida as the hurricanes rolled in. And even one of my shows, I did a short version in person as I was driving through Atlanta, Georgia, in very, very heavy traffic. I called into the station and did my show live as I was driving, escaping the hurricanes and all the traffic and the milieu down there. And that started about a two-month hiatus of travel, of doing various things, and that now is over. So anyway, I'm just happy to tell you that, and things should be getting back to normal very, very soon here. In fact, they are right now. It's just that I have a lot of emails to catch up with. If you've emailed me and haven't had a response, I'm working on catching up on emails and all of that busy work, but still very important work to keep in communication with listeners, etc. And by the way, I'm going to jump back to this topic of the Christmas star for just a second. My estimate of the Christmas star was that not only was it a comet, because we have seen comets in the solar system. Every 10 years, we have a major comet sighting. So once again, that's not the end all of astronomy unusual objects. What would be unusual if there was a comet that came in with not one companion, but two companions? In other words, a triple-headed comet. And the second orbiting pieces of comet nuclei would be orbiting the primary piece, and you would have two comets orbiting the main comet. Now, this would create something that would be very, very unique, something that over a 3,000-year period, you would only see at one time. And so, given more detailed information about that comet, it would be justifiable for the three kings watching the heavens to identify this and go, this is it. You know, there's no question that this is it. And there maybe the periodicity of the orbiting nuclei or whatever that they would distinguish this from any other comet that you might ever see. And so it was, once again, you come back to the fact that there were three kings that saw this. Herod saw this. Other people saw this. They were knowledgeable. And they realized that this was the symbol for the coming of the Magi, the Savior. And so that's why the Christmas star not only was a comet, it was in some manner, in some way, shape, or form, a very unusual comet. Now, we've seen big comets. We've had relatively small comets that have come close to Earth, which make them appear very large. We've had all kinds of different combinations of comets. We've had comets graze the sun and cause electrical discharges and solar flaring, etc. But what would it be about a comet that would set it apart from any other? Because, you know, they're from a distance, they look somewhat the same, whether they're big or small, etc. So something had to be very unique, so ultra unique. And my estimate is that the Christmas star was a triple comet, a triple nucleus comet, something that there, and it, you could also understand that there might have even been a periodicity known of the comet orbiting the orbiting pieces that were orbiting the main piece of the comet nucleus. There may even have been numbers on that, the periodicity of the comet orbiting. So it'd be something so unique that it was just unequivocal. There was just no question that that was the Christmas star. Okay, well, anyway, hope you enjoy that little commentary, because it's very important to understand that comets have played major roles in the history of man. And so that's something else I'm working on. They come up in many pieces of history. And there's recurring comets like Halley's Comet that has been noticed throughout history, and you can follow its orbital period. Just an interesting comet. We always think of periodic comets coming back on a regular basis. And Halley's Comet, you might think, has a period of so many years, 70-some years. That's the repetition cycle that it comes back around the sun. But that's constantly changing. And so that's very interesting. Sometimes it comes back very early. Sometimes it comes back very late and then disappears out into the outer solar system until it comes back the next time. But it might be as many as months early or months late. Now, that's a real interesting little, let's say, fun fact, that comets are constantly changing their orbits. And even the small comets like Halley's. But the big comets like K2, and I say that's big is because it's a speculation based on data. I talked about that in my show last week, so go listen to that, about how they measure or estimate the size of comet nuclei and how it's prone to error, and why the assumptions they make in making those measurements and calculations are basically in error. Switching gears a little bit here, this is kind of a cute story, and so a little, I kind of have to laugh myself, although I'm not sure this guy, let me tell you the story here. This guy believes that the Earth is flat. Now, I'll talk about that in the scientific sense in a minute. But let me just first clarify, the world is not flat. It's locally flat. It's pretty flat where you are, unless you're in a hilly or mountainous region. But if you're out in the middle of Kansas, it looks pretty flat. But it's still curved, and you can actually measure the curvature of the Earth very simply using implements that you can buy at the hardware store. In fact, I was just in a hardware store the other day. One of the things was on sale, and that's a carpenter's level. You don't even need that. You can make the stuff to measure the diameter of the earth just with things you could even make in out of the woods. You could go in the woods and basically, here's how it works. What you need is a level, but you could take a piece of wood that's carved out, like a big piece of wood that's got the center carved out, and you can fill it with water, and that would give you a level, a local gravitational, that the surface of that water in the container is going to be parallel to the earth and perpendicular to the gravitational field of the earth. So by putting this water source or a carpenter's level or whatever up at an elevation of a good elevation, a good beginning elevation would be 600 feet, 200 yards, or 200, couple hundred meters tall or higher. And for example, couple months ago, I was in the Chicago Willis Building, and you go up to the 104th floor, you get a very good view of Lake Michigan, and you could set up this apparatus up there very simply. It's just a tripod and a carpenter's level. But here's what you do. You take the carpenter's level, and then the other thing you need is a mechanism for measuring angles, like a protractor or a compass or something like that. And once again, you can buy that at the local art store, or you could get it at the hardware store also. They sell those for construction. Or you could read off degrees. Or if you wanted to get sophisticated, you could use a old-style surveyor's transit, in which you also have a level and you have a telescope that's can be set up to look out towards the horizon. But basically, here's what you're doing. You take the level, whether it's a gouged out piece of wood with water in it or a bowl with water in it, and you fill it up, and then so the water's not spilling out one side, you basically look across the surface of the water, and that gives you a level. With a carpenter's level, you would just set up the carpenter's level, make it horizontal, and then look out towards the horizon over a lake. And now the other part of this is you would want like a lake like or an ocean that you can see the horizon all the way around. So you look out and you set up your level or your water container, whatever, and then you're looking straight out, and this would be horizontally. And what you're going to find is that the horizon, the lake surface or whatever, is just a little below that. And no matter where you are in planet Earth, it would be the same. The higher you are, the more that horizon is going to be down below the sighting line of the level. And if the world were flat, you have to ask somebody, well, where does the Earth end? You know? And how do you get from, say, Moscow to Minneapolis? There's flights over the pole. How does that work if the Earth is flat? So, I mean, but the end result is don't argue with somebody who thinks the world is flat. Just let them think that. Let them go on their merry way. But kids who want to actually measure the circumference and diameter of the Earth, this is a good way to do it. And then by making some calculations, some trigonometry, and you can determine the diameter of the Earth. The ancient Greeks did this, and they were pretty close. When Columbus came across the ocean the first time, he knew the world was round, but all his sailors thought the Earth was flat. And that is because there was a specific dogma that was taught to the commoners that the Earth was flat, and that was kind of like a mental trap so that they didn't go sailing off across the ocean to find their fortunes. That was only for rich, noble people, etc. So anyway, back to this guy. This guy has built a rocket and he's going to get in his rocket and he's going to shoot himself up into, you know, low Earth somewhere, not very high, I understand. But anyway, and then he's going to hopefully, I mean, if he succeeds part one, he's going to hopefully parachute back to Earth. And somehow he thinks that this is going to prove that the Earth is flat. Good luck, buddy. But anyway, a little light humor there for Thanksgiving. And, you know, I'm not sure how he is claiming that shooting himself up in a rocket, homemade rocket, how this is going to somehow allegedly prove that the Earth would be flat. I haven't figured that out yet, but I guess we'll wait. This is going to occur this coming Sunday, so I guess we'll wait till Monday to see if this guy lives through this deal and, you know, see what he claims he's proving. Anyway, it doesn't get any crazier than that. There is a story floating around, and this is something that keeps recurring in Standard Science, where they talk about how life got from one place to another in outer space. Well, of course, we all know that outer space is an extremely harsh environment, and most people don't really know how harsh it is with radiation, etc. The Earth we live on is extremely shielded. We are shielded from 99% of damaging radiation of all kinds, whether they're high-energy particles or X-rays or gamma rays or ultraviolet light or whatever it is. Most of that is blocked before it gets down to where we live, down in the troposphere. But the ongoing question is, how did life get its beginning? And so science, in its ongoing quest to try and put a marker on this, to try and understand it, or at least get a rudimentary concept of maybe what happened, that with the assumption, of course, that it was by process of evolution. But now they're claiming that dust, which would contain or potentially contain life of some kind, minute life, first cells, etc., could be brought up into the upper atmosphere and then whisked away and then eventually land on another planet where then they would begin to grow there. Okay, well, it's a nice idea. And even if you could prove it, the question still begets the original, where did the original life come from? How did the original life, you know, the first cell, the first organic molecules combined to form the first living entity? This is something I talked extensively about in my paid cast in the past and on my radio show, is the concept of how life got going. And that's something that science keeps throwing darts at the dartboard. So he keeps trying to throw mud and hit the wall. But they've, you know, in spite of the idea that you can create organic molecules with lightning or electrical discharges, etc., nobody, and it's almost an impossibility to understand how living things came from non-living things. What's the difference between a hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen atom that's not organic and one that is organic? What's the difference? Nobody can tell you that, let alone how some combinations, when they get more complex. My definition of life, remember, is a molecular structure that disobeys the second law of thermodynamics. And it's very simple. If you take a ball and roll it downhill, that ball is going to keep rolling down the hill, and the ball itself, being a non-living item, can't decide I'm just not going to roll down the hill anymore. I'm going to stop here for a while. I'm going to conserve my energy. And maybe later I'll roll all the way down the hill the rest of the way if I want. And the difference is that things that are living have the ability to store up energy and not use it at what we call the abiding by the second law of thermodynamics. In other words, the energy is expended whether you like it or not, in the case of the ball rolling down the hill. And of course, we could stop the ball from rolling down the hill if we wanted, but we're living beings, and we have an element of choice and decision making. And you can pick up the telephone if you want. If it rings, you may say, "Well, I don't want to pick it up." And then a second later, you go, "Well, you know, maybe I will." And then you pick it up and answer it. But the whole concept of life is that it doesn't follow the sequence, the normal sequence of events that would happen if the object were inanimate. Inanimate objects follow the laws of physics. They do what happens to them. They're responsive. They if they're rolling down a hill, or if they fall, it's a piece of glass, it's a hard cement surface, it's going to break. All of these, you know, the inanimate objects follow the laws of physics. Living objects do not. And the more advanced they are, they have the ability to store up energy and not use that energy. They can store it up and keep it and use it at will in some respects. And like I say, the more advanced life forms, like humans, have decision-making processes that allow them to actually control their environment, build houses, make furnaces that keep it warm in the wintertime, create telephone systems so when the furnace breaks, you can call the serviceman. You know, that's the difference between living things. But the question, the big, the $64,000 question is, how did this get started? And that's where science, by definition, can never have an answer, because in true science, you would need somebody there to measure and observe the first cell being created out of organic processes or naturally occurring processes. You would need to be there to see this and observe it and record it, not just speculate that's probably what happened. No. Real science requires real observations, requires real data collection and repeatability. That not just happened once, but this happened many times. And you can repeat it. But even if you could do an experiment in a laboratory and say, well, this seems to be what's going on, you still lack the direct verification. By definition, nobody was there when the first organic molecule became living, simply by definition, because we didn't happen along till long, long after that, by any stretch of the imagination, or there was a different set of processes that man was created, and by some process, whether evolving, of course, we're changing all the time, but that isn't the creation of the species. So that's one of the great myths of Darwinian evolution, is that somehow all of this evolved, but there's literally, like I say, no proof. There's a fossil record, I'll agree to that. But there's all of these big gaps in there where there's nothing. So how did, dinosaurs get to birds? Well, it would be nice if we had a more complete fossil record, but we don't. So the question comes along. It's a complicated question. But once again, just eliminating all that, just going back to the original question, where did the original life form? If it's blowing from planet to planet because living things jump on a piece of dust and it goes up in the atmosphere and it gets swooped out of the atmosphere and over to the next planet, okay, maybe. I mean, nobody's measured this, nobody's seen it, nobody's verified this. It's just speculation. And of course, it can get published in a peer-reviewed journal, no problem, because it goes along with the assumed Darwinian evolution concept that's being pounded down everybody's throats as gospel truth. But it always begs the question, where did all of this start from? What was the original entity that started all of this? And nobody can tell you that. Nobody can show you how it works. And nobody, I guarantee you, was there to observe it. So in the true scientific sense, there is no scientific evidence that life evolved out of inorganic random combination of what would later become organic molecules. Organic being basically carbon-based, carbon-oxygen-based, and in the case of, say, nucleotides, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, the four basics, and then add in things like phosphorus and other elements that bridge that the glues that hold these together, etc. But basically, there's no direct evidence that shows how any of this got started. And so it really comes back to a grand design. And so as we look at these things on Thanksgiving Day, there's a lot of things that we don't know. There's a lot of things where modern science tries to make answers. But when you get nose to nose with the people that are propounding this, they really cannot answer the questions. And by definition, if it comes right down to it, you say, okay, somebody's really adamant. Maybe you got a professor in college. You know, he's got a PhD, lots of awards, maybe a Nobel Prize. And you stick it to him and you say, hey, where's the observational proof that this began by evolution? By, you know, and excuse me, if the guy says that there's proof, he's lying to you. Because, believe me, neither him nor anybody else that you know or he knows was there to observe what may have happened or may not have happened. Very simple. Okay, so at any rate, the reason I'm talking about this is because this idea that comets brought life to Earth, or asteroids picked it up from another starry system in the other part of the Milky Way galaxy, and then it rode through outer space, and it came down to Earth, and that's how life got here. That begs the question, well, how did it start over there on that other planet where this asteroid allegedly picked it up? You're not solving the problem by discussing transfer mechanisms between one planet and another. That doesn't solve your problem of how all of this, but it does solve the problem in standard science, because they can pawn this off, teach it in a textbook, and if kids repeat it, they get an A, they advance, they go out and get a job, and life is good. But I'm not of that genre. I'm not depending on going out and getting a job based on, you know, repeating what comes in a textbook and getting an A. Anyway, this is important because this is the kind of banter you get from standard, the scientific community. The idea of life and the structure of life, for example, look at all the different kinds of animals, from fish to people to monkeys in the zoo to birds to dinosaurs to, in the symmetry idea that you have two eyes, generally two ears, a nose, a mouth, teeth in most of them, or some kind of structure in the mouth to aid in consuming essential food that is necessary for this living object to store up food and do his thing, the structure of life is symmetrical. But then, of course, we get into things like the spiral seashells that follow the golden ratio. I mean, life is very complicated. Living things are very complicated. And it's a very complex topic. Needless to say, we really don't understand how this works. We certainly don't know where it came from. So with that thought, I will bid you a very happy Thanksgiving. I just want to remind people that I still have my 10% plus extra 5% off on the water filter products on my webpage. And you can have these shipped to any place in the world. If you have trouble ordering, just email us and we will get back to you and somehow help you through the ordering process. If you've already put in orders, the system will want to keep using your same address. But just, like I say, just put in the order, email us. We'll work with you to get the products because there might be people. In fact, I had a case, was it last year, year before, a doctor ordered water filters for all of his kids. I think he had five, and they were adults. They lived all over the country. And so they put in a single order, and we were able to get the all of the different products to all the different families around the U.S. and by just having one single order. And so anyway, what I'm saying is we'll work with you. Just put in your order, email us when you get the email receipt, email back and say, here's where we want them sent to. And we'll work with you to ship them to the right locations, etc. And normally we don't do that, but Christmas is a little different. And so there's the 10% plus extra 5% off on major water filter items. We've got the sale on the whole house filters. And so the order buttons are there on the webpage, the PayPal order buttons. That's a little different. They don't go through the merchant account just because they're pretty big orders monetarily. And then also the books, etc. And then my paid cast, which is $3.95 a month. I encourage everybody to join that. And with the paid cast, you get every week an extra deep dive into scientific topics where I don't do all of the, I don't talk about water filters. I don't have any advertisements of any kind. I don't have any promotions. I just take a particular scientific topic, usually in series, and jump into that, and then the entire hour is science. And so once again, just go to the webpage and also the wing generator. Read about that on the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my science hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Happy Thanksgiving. Good night.